Zen Buddhist priest Rinchen Bunce joins the Plutopia podcast this time. We discuss Buddhism and Rinchen's life as a priest.
So Soto Zen is no gaining idea. We don't practice, and practice, there are a few words like practice, like God, like love, like life. They have so many meanings. When I say practice, what am I saying? Let's say the hard work of actual on the cushion zazen. So we are taught you can't go to that trying to get something. But of course, if we didn't get some kind of result from it, we wouldn't keep doing it. So back to your starting point, I think, is to actually be so courageous as to not cling to those results.
Welcome to yet another Plutopia News Network podcast. And our guest today is Rinchen Bunce, a Soto Zen Buddhist priest who received Dharma transmission in 2013. So that's like a decade. She worked as a hospice chaplain from 2010 till she retired in 2022. And we will inevitably talk about how various beliefs and practices, even Buddhism, perpetuate delusion. I say that's inevitable because we both have, she is actually a Buddhist priest, and I'm a person with I'm a backsliding Buddhist. I have a long history of studying Buddhism without joining a sangha or getting a teacher, but I've had a lot of teachers along the way. So
backsliding.
Backsliding hard. Anyway, we were going to talk about how beliefs and practices perpetuate delusion and how hard it is to be present in the here and now, especially when your head is full of, you know, concepts and thoughts and all kinds of like weird things that are like the voices in your head, which are not always friendly, you know. And then we can also talk about belief, because I wonder whether we even know clearly what we mean when we say belief. Is a belief just an attachment to a concept? So with all that set up, Ren, what do you think?
So it's your topic. This is not a Dharma talk by me. You know what crossed my mind when you were laying that out is how hard it is to raise one's head above the muck of habit, conditioning, life, everything that's happened, to raise your, once in a while, the head pops up from the muck and we actually get something. We actually understand something, right? What is hard is letting that go. For me, any understandings, any awakenings that I've experienced, yes, I grasp onto them, right? Which I think is what you're talking about. But that's against the teaching. Years ago, I heard Robert Aitken, the late great, one of the very first Westerners to become a Zen master and teach Zen. I heard him say that the problem with the evangelists was, you know, it's easier for us to talk about them than ourselves, that their problem was they had an awakening, but then they kept trading on that awakening. So this comes from the great Robert Aitken. We have to let everything go, even our own understandings, even our own awakenings, even our own enlightenment. We have to let that go.
So one of the questions that came up in one of my conversations not long ago was, what is enlightenment? And one thing that I sort of understand, I'm not claiming that I've I mean, I don't even know for sure what enlightenment is exactly. I may have had it or may not have, but one thing that's clear to me is that it's not something that, it's not like you pass into an enlightened state and stay there.
You're exactly.
You're still exactly who you are, and you don't ascend to some sense of nirvana, some sense of complete bliss. Every day is still hard, you know, and still easy in places too. You know, it's it's all impermanent.
So I'm going to give you a yes and no on that, because the point is that you're not still just who you are, that those direct experiences do change us. And yes, and we still have to, you know, after you've eaten your breakfast, wash your bowl. And the karmic seeds, let's say, that formed me in this particular way, they still function. I've been experiencing so much anxiety lately, and I just, you know, we say Zen is nothing extra. So being anxious is just being anxious. The extra that I bring to it is saying to myself, but you're a Zen Buddhist priest. You shouldn't be anxious. So I do claim a few very important enlightenment experiences. I do. I've been practicing hard for a long time. So one thing I want to say is I can trust that it's an enlightenment experience if it is, it comes like a gift from the outside. It's not me reading a book and agreeing with what it says in the book. And it's not me putting two and two together and inventing four. So once I asked my teacher, we were down at Tassajara, our monastery, and really a lot of Zazen, really a lot of Zazen. And so I said to Steve, is it that in sitting here, not moving the body, which is learning to not move the mind, what the wonderful phrase, cultivating the empty field. So if enlightenment happens to arrive, it'll see that there's a place to land. And Steve said that was, I know, it's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah,
I'm sticking with it. And so that's another thing I'm clinging to is, and I have to write that down. I'm writing a book about Steve. And
well, this has actually been recorded, so you won't lose it.
I don't know about listening again to myself talking. So Soto Zen is no gaining idea. We don't practice, and practice, there are a few words like practice, like God, like love, like life. They have so many meanings. When I say practice, what am I saying? Let's say the hard work of actual on the cushion Zazen. So we are taught you can't go to that trying to get something. But of course, if we didn't get some kind of result from it, we wouldn't keep doing it. So back to your starting point, I think, is to actually be so courageous as to not cling to those results. I went to Bodh Gaya a few years ago. I sat under the Bodhi tree. I sat on the spot where Shakyamuni Buddha sat and had his great awakening. And I had an incredible experience there. I cling to that all the time. So I won't tell you exactly what it was right now, but these experiences are great gifts. They're great encouragements. Let's say they're, you know, as we're walking down the highway of life, they're like signs that we pass that say, yeah, keep going. Yeah, keep going. You're doing fine. Keep going.
You know, I had an experience once that in retrospect, I think was kind of an instance of kinsho, some level of awakening to something. But at the time, I just kind of thought, oh, that's the way it is, you know? And I just thought that I had realized something, but I just thought that it was like something that everybody at some point should realize. And it was only later that I realized that it was maybe, I don't want to call it an enlightenment experience, but something different than the kind of realizations that most people will have, I guess. I'm also realizing, and almost as soon as I said it, I realized that how fallacious it was for me to say, you're still the same you, because you're never the same you, ever. Yeah. You know, yeah. It's always different. I mean, nothing is permanent, including your being, you know, that's changing all the time. But at the same time, you do try to like hold things in place. And especially if you have an experience that feels ascendant like that, you just don't want to let go of it. It's just very hard to let go of it. And but it's already gone. So you don't really have a choice. You can.
I'll touch back to those memories when I need comfort. Right? Because those.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, John, about the gift that Suzuki Roshi gave us of the concept. This is all concept until it's deep understanding. The gift he gave us of small mind and big mind. So big mind is the absolute. Big mind is everything is always changing, including us. Small mind is, you know, I actually do exist. If you pinch me, I say, ow, right? And I say, ow for quite a while. So it was important in my entering Zen when I initially thought the idea was to get rid of this pesky small self and roll around heaven all day in big mind. Yeah. Oh, that was going to be great. And, you know, in the Lotus Sutra, which is one of the essential documents of this the flavor of Buddhism that I'm a part of, the Buddha comes in to give a talk, and I think it's 108 haughty arhats get up and leave because they say, we already know everything. We don't need to hear this guy. So don't be a haughty arhat. So now let me see. I was having so much fun with that. I forgot what I was talking about. That happens.
I think we were talking about impermanence.
Oh, I was talking about, yes, we were. And I was talking about the understanding, there I go again, something I understood decades ago, and I still, well, let's say I refer to it. And it's exactly the kind of thing that I hope to grok. Let's use grok deeply. That is that big mind and small mind, it's not a matter of getting rid of the self and becoming a haughty arhat. What Suzuki Roshi is saying to us is that big mind and small mind exist in the same place at the same time. So we're not choosing between the two. Actually, this personality that I've gone to so much trouble to create in my eternal attempt to be allowed to remain in the room, this personality is manifesting big mind, right? So there's a bunch of concepts for you. And who can ever understand that?
Well, I've been thinking about how, you know, thinking about travel and how when you go somewhere, it's like this place that you're visiting just appeared for you and you're experiencing it. And when you go away, it's going to go away. You know, there's kind of that feeling that people get in their heads. And the truth of it is that it's still there and it's still going along and it's still going through its own changes and that sort of thing. And it's kind of like that with, you know, like with Buddhism. If you didn't have any idea of Buddhism or anything like that, that doesn't mean that reality would be different than it is.
Right.
You know?
Very good. Right.
I mean, things are as they are, and we are as we are, and we're all part of an interdependent thing, but we're somewhat, the delusion part is like being kind of sealed off from that and thinking you're coming into it and coming out of it when you're just always there.
And I'm going to say Buddhism is training in letting things be as they are. That's my understanding of the practical application of all of the teachings, all of the practice. My teacher, Steve, used to bring his guitar into the Zendo, and the song that he always sang, it's an old blues song, and it's called Relax Your Mind. Relax Your Mind. A few years after he died, it dawned on me, oh, what he meant was, relax your mind. Stop trying to control everything, which is what we do, which is what we're trying to control each other. We're trying to control our own bodies. We're trying to control what's going on in Russia because we're so smart, right? Relax, which is, I mean, how cool would that be to let life be life, which is going to happen anyway.
Can a person that's not a practicing Buddhist achieve enlightenment?
Sure.
And how would that happen?
Oh, through, let's say, their fortunate karma. I mean, I don't know how it would happen, but sure. This is, you know, the Shakyamuni Buddha he was not a Buddhist. He didn't invent Buddhism. He realized the truth that was already there. So someone who is nothing, or a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim just walking down the street, sure, they can wake up. How does it happen to anyone?
I've known people who have had experiences that I would say are enlightenment experiences from the way they described them to me, but they were not Buddhists and had nothing to do with Buddhism. And I also have talked to Buddhists or heard from Buddhists that enlightenment experience would come to them without any expectation or without any thought that it was going to come, that it was like lightning hitting, you know, it was like it's not like you can come up with a recipe for getting to the point where suddenly you're enlightened. And some people become enlightened just out of the blue, I think. Enlightened or have an enlightenment experience, because when we say become enlightened, that makes it sound like you become enlightened and then you're enlightened from then on. And I think we already said that that's not exactly the way it works.
So this, we can talk about the way we all took psychedelics when we were young, and some of us even now. And we can, I think, legitimately say that many of us had enlightenment experiences when we were using psychedelics, and many of us turned to one flavor or another of spiritual practice later in life. Not so much to get back to that, but because we knew that that existed. Yes, and to get back to it, because we'd experienced but because it was drug-induced, it was gone the next day.
Some people went to a whole different kind of drug in order to get away from it, too. Some people will have that experience, and it'll scare the hell out of them, I think.
Not me.
Not me either, but I've known people who were like that.
Yeah.
You know, didn't know what to do with it. Well, I thought Scoop was going to say something else. Scoop?
Well, actually, I can. I'm, you know, not a practicing Buddhist. I think I might be a Buddhist appreciator from being associated with John and various people over the years. But I meditate every day. And, I'm not looking for enlightenment, perhaps. I'm looking for a chance to be in another world than the one I'm experiencing most of the day, which is hectic and confusing at times. And meditation just gives me that chance to unplug and drift away. I haven't had any enlightenment, but I don't know if that's what I'm looking for. Is that the wrong thing to be doing with your meditation? Or is it okay just to meditate, to relax, and to unplug your mind?
There's no wrong thing. If it's working for you, that's terrific. What you describe is not some Buddhist meditation, but so what? Because what you describe is a practice that you do every day, and it's working for you, great. There are all kinds of meditation and all kinds of reasons to meditate.
We talked before, recently, we had started this conversation before and are coming back to it, where we were talking about reality, you know, and one thing that I understand about the Buddhist path is that part of it is about finding your way to be in the present with what's real in the present without a lot of like distracting noise in your head and that sort of thing. But is there, there are some people who believe that there is no one objective reality. And what do we really know about that? And can we really know what's real in a big sense, given that we have limitations? Our senses, for instance, are limited in what they can perceive. That sounds a little bit like the old comic book question. What is reality?
What's reality for me is, I'll be right back. I have to get a Kleenex. I'm so excited that my nose is running.
Oh, I'm glad that we were able to elicit a response.
Yeah, reality. I say when I write and I talk about myself that I started meditating, which was very, very unpleasant for me, but I started and continued meditating because I was so tormented by wanting to know what reality was, knowing that whatever was going on inside my head and whatever was in my life, that I was only seeing a small slice of what might be possible. My reality, your reality, the reality, I don't know. But I do know this. We have a lot more control than we think in guiding our lives, our moods, our mind states. In seated meditation, we become familiar with the way our minds work. Mm-hmm. So it becomes more possible early in a thought train to catch it and guide it away from habit, right? The old habits of anxiety and depression. Perhaps there's something else. We can see that thought train and we can actually say, nah, let's do something else. I would try this when I was working as a hospice chaplain, and some of my people, you know, they were just in such mental difficulty. And I would try to say, do you know you have some control over that? and maybe a couple of them heard it. This is my me, Ren. This is my experience of reality. This is hard to talk about. The power of our own mind. Just to make myself not be depressed. Yeah, there's a simple example. Let's not do that. I don't know. Did that make any sense?
Yeah. And I'm remembering when you took psychedelics that some of the filters came down. Our reality, our perception of reality is filtered to some extent for practical reasons, you know, so that we can kind of move in the world without being totally overwhelmed by all the potential things that we could perceive. And when you take a psychedelic drug, one of the things that happens is that you kind of open up and you perceive more of that stuff. And I think I have trouble deciding whether that's really a pathway to enlightenment or just some more delusion, whether that perception is a perception of things as they really are, or that with the filters removed, whether you're still like making stories in your mind about what it is you're experiencing that are not accurate, you know?
I think psychedelics is the fast way that fades. And I think meditation is the slow way that sticks, of scraping away those layers of habit and conditioning. I had an interaction with a woman in her 60s, and she said, "Well, my mother always said to me," and I thought, "Really? You're 60 years old and you're still doing what your mother told you to do?" But in a way, we all are. So to be able to see that, I mean, there's delusion. Is it gets planted in us deeply. You have to do this, you must not do that. To see that and stop believing it, right? The great saying, don't believe everything you think. So with psychedelics, yes, all of that is, you're wide open, but it fades. With meditation, slowly, 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 love the image of water dripping on a rock, right? How do you get a hole in a rock? It takes a long time, but it does happen. So getting that space around our concepts, actually, and so here, finally, John, we've arrived at what you wanted to talk about, which was delusion. That's delusion. For instance, just off the top of my head, we're living in a world that tells us if you go shopping, you'll be happy. And in a world where it tells us if you don't have the money to go shopping, you're not going to be happy. Can we see through that? It's big. I was in the monastery after 9/11, but I heard that President George Bush, remember him? President George Bush told people the way to get back to the way things were was, would everybody please go shopping? And that's incredible. So for us to see through that mass delusion and have the good fortune to find some other people who are also interested in finding another way to be happy. It's not just another, here it comes, John, pink cashmere sweater, alas.
Ren, I'd like to get your opinion on something. I tried to smarten myself up about Buddhism before our interview here. And I ran across something about a Zen monastery in Vermont called Maple. Soryu Forall is the monk, and he's predicting the apocalypse as a result of artificial intelligence. And he's now becoming an AI guru. Is that something you is he the only one predicting the apocalypse, or is this an outlier that we should probably not even bother with?
Well, I think you don't have to be in a monastery in Vermont to think that there are dangers attached to AI. I've never heard of the guy. Maybe he's right, but I've never. But I love it. Scoop, I also am trying to smarten myself up about Buddhism. Remember, too, that when we say Buddhism, that's big, right? When we say Christianity, that's big. That goes from Thomas Merton to Jerry Falwell, just off the top of my head. So a lot in America, in my chaplaincy, people would say they were Buddhists, and what they really were was not Christians. They wanted something, but it wasn't Christianity. So there are a lot of different schools of Buddhism, but good luck to the guy in Vermont and to the people Roshi bought.
Oh, okay.
Oh, this is my friend Jiryu did Roshi bought. And we are in, I'm a member of Soto Zen Buddhist Association, which is, I'm going to get you back to full screen. Soto Zen Buddhist Association is trying to legitimize us in America. And Jiryu sent Roshi bought to our listserv, and everyone went absolutely crazy. And the argument about Roshi bought was, but we have Roshis. Why do we need to have artificial intelligence poorly digest what the great teachers have said? So it's another thing I've heard about meditation practice is that it develops our intuitive nature. So it's up to us. You know, you meet someone, are you going to trust this person or not? To be able to make that choice. And then there's the other old saying, when you meet the Buddha in the road, kill him. Which is,
I found,
don't follow leaders, watch the parking meters.
I found other bots. There's a Chogyam Trungpa bot, and then there's Roshi bot, and then of course there's the like Google Bard and ChatGPT and so forth. I asked all of these systems, all of these AI systems, the question, what is enlightenment? And it was a pretty interesting set of answers. The answers were more nuanced than I expected. But, you know, a bot is really just a system that draws on knowledge bases of various kinds. It's just like a way of, you're querying a database when you ask it a question. And I'm pretty sure that when you're talking to your Zen teacher, you're not querying a database.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that might be, the human thing, we have, and Doug Rushkoff has influenced me in this to really favor humanity over machines and also over inhumane practices.
Yeah. And I think the bots are, for us, they're an entertainment.
Yeah, it's true.
If you want to know what enlightenment is, step away from the computer. Right.
Well, and who knows what enlightenment is? I mean, if you've had an experience of enlightenment, you have an idea what that was, but you don't know what anybody else's experience was. So, what objective measure might we have to assess the nature of enlightenment, really?
The objective, long time ago, there was a bumper sticker quoting the Dalai Lama. It said, "My religion is kindness." So we could, this fellow fellow in Vermont who's predicting the end or whatever, is he kind? There's a great measure. Is this person kind in the world? Then they must be enlightened.
I mean, I would say that, I was just going to say, I would say that if you foresee an apocalypse, then you should bring a great compassion to that assumption, you know. I would expect someone who is using those terms, you know, there's an AI apocalypse coming, to be working with compassion quite a bit. I don't know whether that's the case with him, but that's what I would expect.
You know, various religious groups over the many years that I've been around have been predicting the end of times, the end of days, the apocalypse, you know, doom, whatever. And they always give you a date, or they used to. I've noticed they've stopped doing that because there were so many people that gave us an exact date of when the end of times was, and it came and went, and they had to deal with the embarrassment of predicting the end that did not occur. So it's kind of hard to predict the apocalypse.
So this is our huge need to know. It's our yearning for certainty in a world in which there is none. What do you have there, John? What are we looking at? Is this the Vermont guy?
I couldn't unmute while I was sharing, oddly enough. But yes, this is Scoop. Can you confirm for me that this is what you were looking at? It says Monastic Academy, but it's called Maple as well.
Yeah, that wasn't what I was looking at. I was looking at an article in the Atlantic. But this
there
is
there you go. This is it.
This is Maple.
So this, as you can see, includes what they call an AI residency for those working at the intersection of AI and existential risk.
But that's something else. That really doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about.
It is kind of interesting.
Okay.
So I shouldn't go cash in all my stocks get ready for the apocalypse.
I don't know what you should do.
I don't think anyone does.
Well, I would just say that all of us have an apocalypse coming. It may just be one of us at a time, but... Mm-hmm.
I was starting to want to say that it's an indication of our desire to know. We need to know, we need certainty for our own comfort, right? Investigating reality, living in this way, it actually is very uncomfortable, right? Living in a world where everything is always changing, where there's no place to stand, is very uncomfortable. So we just make shit up and say it's true.
I would think it would be bad to know when the end is scheduled for an individual, because that would totally, you know, derail their lifestyle, I would imagine, or their life. Personally, I really don't want to know. I'm just going to do the life, and when it's gone, then it's gone.
Sometimes I think I'd like to know. I'd like to know because I'd like to know how to spend my money, right? I'm retired. I have X amount of money, and I don't want to leave any on the table when I'm dead. Yeah, sometimes back to that yearning for certainty, sometimes I think I would like to know, but too bad if I do, because nobody does.
Some people have a better idea than others, though, when they get a prognosis that says, oh, you have 6 months to live. Then you figure maybe I'll have more or less than 6 months, but that's probably pretty close. And from all I've heard, that is an occasion for real growth when people get that kind of prediction.
Could be.
I mean, you worked in hospice. You probably were around a lot of situations like that.
I sure was. And I thought for most of us, it was an occasion for great resistance. Nope, don't want to die. Nope. A few people who were very helpful to me were people who, when they got their terminal diagnosis, were angry because they realized they had followed all the rules. They'd been living a conditioned, doing what society says life, and they realized how much they had missed by doing that, particularly women. I'm thinking of a few women who talked to me about that. Those are great teachers for those of us who are determined to color outside the lines in our own lives. So no, John, this idea that when we realize death is near, that we have a spiritual awakening and we are a whole new saintly person. No, I did not see that.
Well, I didn't say saintly, but just that people tend to grow a bit. But I don't know. I mean, I've heard people say that, people who have had that experience. I've also known people who had a prognosis that of short term, you know, that they would die within some number of months or a couple of years or whatever, and they just kept charging along. And years later, they're fine. You know, I mean, years later, they're feeling pretty spunky. And what can you say to that? Well, yeah. And it's because they ignored the Reaper. They said, well, the hell with this. I'm just going to do what I do, you know?
Yeah. But net, nobody wants to die. Back to Robert Aitken. I heard him say his wife, Anne, was dying. And he said that she was doing it with an air of curiosity, that she was greeting death saying, oh, what is this? I think that's the best advice on how to die I've ever heard.
I would hope that I could do that.
Yeah, most of us are just saying, oh, shit.
That's right.
I was impressed by the way my dad went. He knew he had liver cancer, and he knew he had, you know, X number of months to go. And he just called the whole family together, said, you know, I'm leaving, and don't get all upset. You know, I'll take care of what's, you know, expected of me in dying. But, you know, let's have a nice get together, and then you go on with your lives, and you can come to the funeral. And that's how it was played out. And he went out gracefully.
You had a good example. Yeah, great. That happens too.
So I want to ask about a particular, speaking of concepts, a concept in Buddhism, an idea from Buddhism that's, I think, an important part of the teaching, which is dependent origination. The idea that all things are arising together and all things are interdependent. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, except it might not be an idea. It might be true. That might be reality.
It seems to be when you look at it, but that means that we're all in a kind of, that we're just flowing along, you know, and
together,
and we're constantly emerging, you know,
together. How about that?
I'm not quite sure what to do with it, but it sounds pretty good.
Well, here we are, because it sounds pretty good. How do we live it?
Well, I mean, does this mean that I am emerging together with Donald Trump?
Yes.
Uh-oh. Why can't I slow that man down?
are you emerging together with an oak tree and a butterfly and Marsha and
various rocks and trees.
Yep.
Mountains.
So back to Suzuki Roshi. Suzuki Roshi's basic, that's risky to say. He has many basics. Suzuki Roshi, and for those who don't know, I'm talking about the Japanese priest who came to America, and around him grew this large institution that still exists called San Francisco Zen Center. And there is this book of his talks called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. In going through that book, Suzuki Roshi says, if you want to stop suffering, stop creating duality. In my view, the basic duality that we are all creating is a duality between me, this fixed self, Renshin, rawr, here I am. That's one thing. Number two thing is everything else. Often in this construct of, say, a reason for this construct is I'm the most important thing. Everything exists to please me or to irritate me. Everything exists for me to have an opinion about. This is duality. If I can actually get beyond that and understand the interconnectedness, understand the effect that we have on each other, understand that everything is changing, then maybe I can understand everything is changing together. It's subtle. It is awakening to understand it. And when I do, particularly if I'm having difficulties, if I remember to join myself to everything, if I remember when I'm having difficulties that I'm not alone and in peril, that's where true comfort lies for me, is in. But John, it's a concept that I've heard about and read about, that I've understood like that. Here's a concept that I cling to. Mm-hmm. Does that
me
make
too.
Sense?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's maybe it's less of a concept and more of a realization.
A realization that comes and goes.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget. When I was still living at City Center, San Francisco at that time was, Market Street was rough. It isn't, I mean, anymore. It's a third world country. But I'd walk down Market Street, and each person I'd see, I'd think, Buddha, 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 all beings, not choosing. This is a very helpful exercise for me to really understand that I have a piece of paper on my refrigerator for years, and it's Thomas Merton, the great Thomas Merton, Christian mystic, saying, you know, our job is to love others without judging whether or not they are worthy. I mean, there's a great way to live, and everything that we're talking about is how do we live? How do we be human? How do we do this? Right? Well, how about loving everybody without judging whether they're worthy of my love? That's really good instructions.
Not easy.
Oh, so not easy. When they're so irritating. If they wouldn't be so irritating, it would be easier to love them.
Like, well, we're all just exactly the same, only different.
So different.
So you mentioned Suzuki Roshi. Were you ever in his presence? Did you meet him?
Love this story. After college, I rented an apartment at the corner of Bush and Laguna. And I had a neighbor who was a little mentally turbulent. He said, you see that building across the street? He said, that is a Zen center, and this Roshi has come from Japan, and you can go over there and you can meditate with him. It's Zen. So I said to my mentally turbulent, I'm sticking with that, my mentally turbulent neighbor, what is Zen? He said, it's a way to end desire. I was a young alcoholic just out of college, loose in the world. I was just getting going with desire. I did not walk across the street. I did not meet Suzuki Roshi. I have to say, my neighbor was misinformed. Zen is not a way to end desire. Zen is a way to live with these endless desires. So that's, nope, I didn't meet Suzuki Roshi. I met Richard Baker, who was his Dharma heir. And my teacher, Steve, his teacher was Mel Weitzman, and Mel was certainly a student directly of Suzuki Roshi. So I'm in the lineage.
And Mel was in Oakland, is that right?
Berkeley
Zen Center.
He's a great, great, great guy, great teacher. Died.
I've heard
a couple
amazing
years
stories
ago.
About him. Yeah.
Yeah, he was great.
Not so sure about Richard Baker or what happened with him. Well, I know some of the stories about some of the problems that he had at the Zen Center and why he left. But
yeah, that's a story.
Those things happen.
Yep.
Several of the books that I've read about Zen were all Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, because every time I read it, it was a different book.
I know. Yeah. I know. Isn't it cool?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Wow, I never saw that talk before.
That's the book that taught me that the reading of a book is not just you're getting what the author gives you, but you're in a process with the author. You're bringing something to it too. And that's why every time we read a book, it's different, because we're coming at it from a different place, you know?
Further down that path.
That book is always, I mean, there's always something new in that book. It's just kind of amazing.
Yeah, John mentioned a problem at the Zen Center. How do Zen Buddhists resolve internal problems? Is there a practice, or is it just like any other disagreements, you argue it out?
There's no such thing as something all Zen Buddhists do. So I can talk about maybe how it's done at San Francisco Zen Center. I can talk about how I do it. There's no such thing as Zen Buddhists. And let's say that if we go back to my religion is kindness, then that would be a really good way to approach problems. There's something I want to say about an idea. Say I can talk about living in the monastery. There's an idea that in the monastery, everything's peaceful, everyone's holy, there's no problems, zoom, 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 zoom. And it's almost the opposite of that. I'm going to say that Zen practice is a practice of being everything. So in that ideal image of a Zen monastery, for instance, I would never get angry. But how can I exclude anger, which is a part of being human? So again, living in a monastery is a process of learning how to live with anger, my own and others.
So living in a monastery would be peaceful if it wasn't for all those human beings.
You got it. Yeah, all those human beings being human beings. But of course, with a singleness of purpose to wake up and not have, and not have things like anger destroy their lives. Yes. But again, there's no, I mean, for Christians too, Scoop, right? How do Christians handle conflict? How many kinds of Christians are there? Now, what does John have us looking at?
Oh, I just thought I would show you this. This is a Thai film that I saw some years ago about a murder in a Buddhist monastery.
Yeah.
And one of the Buddhists in the monastery is a former policeman, and he's sort of charged with solving the murder.
It could, yeah. I lived at Zen Center for 7 years, and 3 of those years were in the strict monastery, and it was just great to have that intense experience of disappointment and and seeing who was causing the problem, and it wasn't them, lots and lots of formal meditation.
And nobody got murdered.
I'm thinking here. So we are at an hour. Do you want to pick up one little loose piece before we close?
Do you know of a loose piece that we can pick up?
We have hit a lot of big points.
You know, what I think is that we're probably going to want to do this again sometime, because it's just hard to cover everything.
I enjoy this so much. Here's something I want to say. I got my first copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I went to Green Gulch and I heard Richard Baker give the talk. I had lunch with him. I got my first copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind at a time in my life when I was desperate. It was the very end of my drinking. So I opened up Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind thinking the answer will be here. And all I saw was he kept talking about meditation, and I knew meditation was not the answer for me. I got sober a couple months after that. I opened that book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, again 10 years later. It was 10 years before I could concentrate through one of those talks. And I'm going to say it's 10 more years before I could make any sense of them. I think Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is the graduate course. And I want to say, and I teach from it in my sitting group. That's what we do, is read it together. In my online sitting group, we have been reading a new collection of talks from Joko Beck that is magnificent.
Yeah, I've read Joko Beck. She's amazing.
But this new one, I'm looking across the room to see, it's called Ordinary Wonder. And it is so simple. It is so clear. And it is so helpful. Her way of combining psychology and the ancient teachings, I don't know anyone who does it better. So I'm just doing a shout out for the most recent book of talks by Joko Beck. It is so helpful. And here I am, I'm a teacher, I'm engaged in practice for 30 years, and this book is really,
I actually
helpful.
Read that book too.
Yeah.
I thought it was profound, and I probably should read it again. And it'll be a different book when I read it.
Because you can't step in the same river twice.
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much.
Is that good for today? It's a pleasure.
That was a pleasure for us as well.
Thank you.
And we'd love to do this again.
I'm here for you.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.